Welcome to Nancy's Bookshelf, a weekly program of conversations with writers in the studios of North State Public Radio. Now here's your host, Nancy Wiegman.
The history of California can't be written without writing the history of John Bidwell. My guest today used John Bidwell's own words to tell the story of California in his book, John Bidwell and California, The Life and Writings of a Pioneer, 1841 to 1900. Professor Michael Magliari teaches California history and the history of the American West at California State University, Chico. He's also active in the Chico community, currently serving on the board of directors for both the Bidwell Mansion Association and the Chico Historic Heritage Association. Welcome, Professor. You actually wrote the book with one of your colleagues in the history department, Michael Gillis, who unfortunately passed away after the book was published.
Yeah, Mike passed away kind of unexpectedly, about been a year almost, just before last Easter. So it's been a real loss to all of us in the history department at Chico State.
Yeah, in fact, when I mentioned his name, I got people's reactions were that they were just very fond of him, and I understand the students were as well. So that I know that is a loss.
I think they were more fond of him than me. So.
Well, but the book you two produced is quite an interesting one. It's a hybrid of two genres. It's actually a biography and an anthology. And how did you pull that off?
Well, actually, the book was Mike's idea originally, and he wanted to put together a collection of Bidwell readings. So it was going to be an anthology of John Bidwell's voluminous writings, with brief introductory sections that we would write about various topics in Bidwell's life. And the brief introductory sections got longer and longer and longer the more we needed to explain and set the context for whatever section of the book, the topical section of the book, Bidwell and the Indians, Bidwell and the Gold Rush, Bidwell and the Overland Trail, Bidwell and the Chinese, and so forth. Mm-hmm. And what happened was, as each introductory section grew, we ended up with half a biography. So really, this it is an original new biography of Bidwell that's interspersed with his writing. So we ended up calling it a biographical anthology.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, that's interesting that you do have to fill in some of the gaps to make the story complete, particularly since we don't know anything from his writings before he started keeping the journal on the Overland Trail. Mm-hmm. So you had to fill in what happened. Who was this person before he started on this adventure?
Right. And the introductory section to the Overland Trail, we had to give Bidwell's life up to 1841 and then set the whole context of the California Trail so that when you read the sections from his overland journals and his overland recollections, you can understand what it is he's talking about, because he doesn't always provide that explanatory information in his own writings.
Well, tell us how he got started. Do you even have any idea why he decided to go across over this huge country into California? Because when it started, John Bidwell was not in California, and California was not even in the United States.
Right. He was leaving the United States. He was heading for what was then Mexican territory, and a lot of Americans moving west were willingly doing that. Some probably assumed the flag would follow them, but I don't think that was the case in Bidwell's own situation. He was never real clear, never made a clear public statement about why he moved to California. He gave two or three different explanations over the course of his life, and one was simply he wanted more adventure. At one point, he
well, because he was young. I mean, a young man would be adventure would be a big attraction,
right? And but he later told people that he came west to California to help make it part of the United States, which is clearly not true. that was not something he was part of at all or thinking about at all in 1841.
But he was pretty determined, because all the people who said they were going to go with him all dropped out. And
right.
There he was by himself to start out. So his starting point was Missouri.
Right, right. And yeah, he was a very determined guy. And so once he made the decision to go, for whatever reasons, he was bound to do it. But we really don't know exactly why he left. He had had some trouble in Missouri. He had tried homesteading in Missouri, had his homestead claim jumped. But that still didn't explain why he felt he needed to go clear to California instead of just claim another piece of government land on the Missouri frontier.
And this was the first overland group to cross the Rockies into California. Is that true?
The Bidwell-Bartleson Party is significant because it was the first group of overland settlers to come across. Mm-hmm. Others had done it before.
As explorers.
The mountain men, the explorers, right. But this was the first party of actual settlers. Mm-hmm. They would have been the first wagon train to make it all the way across, except their wagon didn't make it. They made it, but the wagons didn't. So they don't have that honor. The first successful party to take wagons all the way through came later on, about 1843.
Well, now you mentioned another character. You call this party the Bidwell-Bartleson Party.
Right.
And who is this other character that gives his name to this group?
John Bartleson was originally elected the captain of the group. He was older, more experienced guy. He had a little following accompanying him on the trail, which lent him some power within the train. So he was able to get himself elected at the outset as captain of this overland group. He turned out to be a very poor leader. They had all kinds of problems with Bartleson during the trip. Bidwell was never the leader of it. The reason his name has been attached to the Bidwell-Bartleson Party ever since is because he became so successful after coming to California. And it was only in retrospect, really, that the party came to be known as the Bidwell-Bartleson Party.
So they start across, and you mentioned that the wagons that they started in didn't make it the whole way.
Right.
And why did they decide they didn't want to take the wagons across?
Well, their draft animals were failing. And, also the condition, the physical condition of the road. There was no road across the wilds of the Great Basin, Utah and Nevada. When they got to those deserts, the terrain was too difficult for the wagons. And the draft animals, the oxen, began to fail, and they were way too weak to pull wagons. So the wagons had to be abandoned in what's now northeastern Nevada, short of the Humboldt River.
So when they got there, this is a part of the book that I enjoyed, mm-hmm. when Bidwell is talking about what happens when they decided, okay, that we can't take these wagons, we're just going to put our packs on the animals.
Right. At that point, the wagon train became a pack expedition, a pack train, went from a wagon train to a pack train. And most of them, the guys in the party, had not had experience packing animals, and so there were problems.
Would you read that part from Bidwell's journal?
Okay, from his recollections of this moment, a key moment in the trip, Bidwell recalled, quote, packing is an art, and sometimes that only an experienced mountaineer can do so well as to save his animal and keep his pack from falling off. We were unaccustomed to it, and the difficulties we had at first were simply indescribable. It is much more difficult to fasten a pack on an ox than on a mule or a horse. The trouble began the very first day, but we started, most of us on foot, for nearly all the animals, including several of the oxen, had to carry packs. It was but a few minutes before the packs began to turn. Horses became scared, mules kicked, oxen jumped and bellowed, and articles were scattered in all directions. We took more pains, fixed things, made a new start, and did better, though packs continued occasionally to fall off and delay us.
So that was one of many, the trials and tribulations of going across. And speaking of the wagons and the oxen were slowing them down, and then this character, Captain Bartleson, decides, oh, this whole train is slowing him down.
Right.
I understand it. So he decides, well, you guys can just go to, and I'm going to go on and go to California without you. So off he goes.
Right. He and his cadre took off, and they experienced more trouble and came sort of slinking back with their tails between their legs. And they were welcomed back by the group pretty generously.
Yeah, that kind of surprised me because after he'd insulted them, saying, you guys are too slow, I'm out of here. And then he has to come crawling back. And they took him back.
Yeah, they took him back.
The section two, when Bidwell says that this is tough and sometimes you're hungry and you're thirsty, and would you read that section of his journal?
Oh, just the difficulties and the exasperations of the travel. He says, quote, "When you travel all day without water and so forth, you are hungry and perhaps have to go half a mile for something to make a fire with. And when we could not find anything else, we had to pick up buffalo chips. If there is anything bad in a man's character, it will show then. They used to say that even a preacher could not cross the plains without swearing."
So these kinds of things really tested your patience when you couldn't find what you needed to build a fire, and you were just—it was pretty.
Oh yeah, this was no easy journey.
So even at their point, sometimes they had a guide who knew what he was doing, but for the most part, I think they just said, "Okay, we've got to go west," and that was about as much as they knew. We're heading west.
Right. I mean, there were really no road maps at all available. No real marked trail. There were just some writings available from some of the fur traders who had crossed the Great Basin. But essentially, when they left the main Oregon Trail at Soda Springs, their directions simply were basically to go west. That was about all there was to it.
Well, one thing that I wondered about, and you say he's writing these notes later after after the fact, because I walked across Spain. I walked over the Pyrenees, and I kept thinking about John Biddle's experience because I had a well-marked path and also was wearing a pedometer. So I had an idea of how many miles I walked per day. But I was wondering, Bidwell often says, well, we went 9 miles this day. We went 12 miles this day. How did he know that?
I think those were just rough estimates. He did bring across a book on celestial navigation, and I don't know if he ever was able to actually use it or not. I don't think he had a sextant with him or anything like that. But in the California State Archives, there is a copy of the book he brought over with him on celestial navigation.
But it was rough because they were running out of food. And it's very suspenseful. It's just, if you were watching this as a movie, you would wonder, are they going to make it? Because their food is running out.
Yeah, when they got to the Sierra crossing was the most difficult part. By that time, they were exhausted, and then they were suddenly faced with the very worst terrain and the least marked and known terrain of all. And a lot of frustrating attempts to get up the eastern Sierra, which is very steep. And they had a lot of dead ends, box canyons, where they had to move, hike, and exhaust themselves only to turn around and try all over again some new route, following streams up into the hills looking for a passable summit. And they never really did find one. Today, the place where the Bidwell-Bartleson party crossed the Sierra, there are no roads across that. They didn't find a summit like Donner Pass or Ebbets Pass or Carson's Pass. They missed all of those. And the actual Bidwell-Bartleson crossing point is as remote today as it was then.
So they're crossing, they're running out of food, but there was the wildlife was very plentiful. And there's a section that he writes about the buffalo and how numerous they were. And I think that is so touching, the way he responds to his compatriots regarding the buffalo. Would you read that section, what he wrote?
Yeah, what he writes about the buffalo sounds very prophetic based on what would happen.
What we know now.
And when just 40 years after when he was writing in 1841. Here he said, they're all along the valley of the Platte River crossing the plains in June of 1841. Quote, "There were 8 or 10 buffalo killed today, but not 1/10 of the meat was used. The rest was left to waste upon the prairie. The valley," referring again to the Platte River Valley, "throughout its whole length and breadth is nothing but one complete slaughter yard where the noble animals used to graze, ruminate, and multiply in uncounted thousands, but they are fast diminishing. If they continue to decrease in the same ratio that they have for the past 15 or 20 years, they will ere long become totally extinct. It has been but a few years since they left the frontiers of Missouri and are now fast retreating towards the Rocky Mountains. The Indians are anxious to preserve them, and it is said of them that they never kill as long as they have any meat remaining. Behold, with indignation, the shameful and outrageous prodigality of the whites, who slaughter thousands merely for their robes and leave the meat, which is far more delicious than that of tame cattle, to waste or to be eaten by wolves and vultures.
My guest is Professor Michael Magliari. I interviewed him 11 years ago, but am rerunning the interview because it's John Bidwell's 200th birthday. You're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm Nancy Wigman. I'm Nancy Wigman, and you're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. My guest today is history professor Michael Magliari. I'm rerunning the interview because it's John Bidwell's 200th birthday.
When he gets to California, I just imagine how wonderful that must have been. It was full of grizzly bears, though. And at one point, Bidwell does his share of killing. But one time when he killed a grizzly bear and he couldn't haul the whole thing with him, so he cut off the bear's paws and kind of used that as leverage over some Indians he ran into. Mm-hmm. Do you remember that?
Yes, yeah. And
don't mess with me. Look, I just killed a bear.
Right. He killed a bear. And it is surprising to read, hear the counts of the Sacramento Valley. I mean, you think of grizzly bears when they were here. You think of them as being in the mountains, in the Sierras. But at that point in the 1840s, they were as common on the valley floor and even along the coast of California. Grizzly bears could be found. They were all over, not just in the mountains.
So they had the problem of watching out for grizzly bears. They were a threat. And, of course, Indians all along the way, because the white settlers viewed the Indians as untrustworthy and dangerous. Bidwell didn't feel that way, but the others did. So there was the threat of being killed by Indians, by a grizzly bear. So there was danger, really. Serious danger confronting these settlers as they came across.
Oh, yeah. There's no doubt about it. There was just a whole list of risks and dangers that they were facing. I mean, the Indians turned out to be not a problem until they got to the Sierra. That was the only place where they had any difficulty with Indian tribes they encountered along the way.
And also the Indians would steal their animals, particularly horses. The Indians were fond of horse meat.
Oh, yeah. I mean, the livestock of Americans and Europeans, those were enormously attractive to Native Americans, especially those groups that were hunters and gatherers, especially those hunter-gatherer groups that were living in very difficult areas where food supply is scarce and making a living by hunting and gathering is enormously difficult, like the wilds of Nevada.
I imagine the Indians stole the horses to ride to go hunt other game, but they were stealing horses to eat them.
Oh, yeah, especially in the in Nevada, the Paiutes and the Goshoot Indians, they kind of watched the wagon train and basically would try to take cattle that were being left behind or being abandoned.
And they'd have to track down their animals. In fact, I think that's how Bidwell discovered, if I want to use that word, first arrived in the Chico area. He was looking for some lost animals. Is that true? That brought him into this area?
Right. There were stolen, stolen horses from the party of Oregonians that Bidwell was trying to help recover. And that's when he was later on in Sutter's employ.
Now there's another main character that we've all heard about in California, John Sutter. Mm-hmm. And here Bidwell knew John Sutter. And not only knew him, but was employed by him.
Yeah, they were very close. And I, Mike Gillis and I always got the feeling that for Bidwell, John Sutter kind of served as a surrogate father. I mean, we've always speculated about that because Bidwell didn't talk much about his father. And if you read between the lines, he seemed to have had a pretty difficult relationship with his father. I think he made one comment about him at all, and that was that he was very severe or stern. And that was the only thing he ever said about the guy.
But John Sutter was very fond of John Bidwell because he wanted Bidwell to marry his daughter.
Yeah, and Bidwell was a very valuable employee, a very trustworthy, hardworking, intelligent employee. And Sutter really wanted to keep Bidwell in his employ at Sutter's Fort. And I think Bidwell felt very close to Sutter because Sutter gave him a job right off the bat when he arrived in California. Gave him enormous responsibilities. He becomes the bookkeeper, among other things, at Sutter's Fort. He's placed in charge of dismantling Fort Ross, the Russian fort, and bringing all the property back to Sutter, who had purchased it from the Russians. So he was given, Sutter trusted Bidwell with a lot of responsibility. And so they were close. And we've always felt that because of that, Bidwell turned a blind eye to Sutter's many, many failings. And I think Bidwell forgave in John Sutter all kinds of things that he never would have forgiven in anybody else. But I think he gave Sutter a pass for the remainder of Sutter's life on a lot of things, from drinking and sexual behavior to Sutter's brutality and violence. I think Bidwell felt so personally close and in such debt to Sutter that he was willing to forgive him a lot of things that he never would have tolerated for a moment in other people.
Well, and two, because of Bidwell's visibility, then he becomes politically important to California, and which wasn't a member of the United States at the time. So Bidwell goes to Washington to ask that California be admitted to the Union. So he was right there on the scene when California was born as a state.
Right. I mean, he participates in the Bear Flag Revolt. And then when the Mexican War breaks out, he participates again on the side of the American conquest. When he had to make a choice between the United States or Mexico, he did go with the United States. So he's at Sonoma at the raising of the Bear Flag, and then he's marching around California during the Mexican War as part of John Fremont's command.
Yeah, another historical figure that Bidwell is close to.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, he didn't.
Not.
Yes, he knew Fremont, didn't like Fremont.
Yeah.
He was very critical of Fremont in his later writings, which are pretty interesting.
So California becomes a state, and Bidwell is there pleading the case to be a state. But when he goes back to Washington, he can get there in 3 weeks. He goes by an ocean route instead of crossing in 6 months like he did the first time he came to California.
Right. The return trip was a big contrast to the arrival. I mean, it is a remarkable. It showed you how much things had changed
just
thanks to the gold rush.
Yeah,
the gold rush. Yeah, I mean, thanks to the gold rush, there was steamship service from the east coast of the United States to California by way of the Panama Isthmus. You did have to still make the overland crossing at Panama, but the rest of it from San Francisco to New York was all by steamship. Still took a long time by our standard, but for him, it was quite a contrast compared to the overland journey.
So now we're coming to the period of time in the Civil War, and I found that very fascinating because his life was threatened. I mean, Bidwell was always – somebody was threatening his life every time he turned around. But they would arrest somebody if they were hurrahing – that was the word that he – hurrahing for Jefferson Davis. They would be arrested and made to carry heavy packs until they signed a loyalty oath. I just found that bizarre.
Yeah, well, I mean, the home front Civil War is a fascinating period. There were a lot of suppression of civil liberties to meet the emergency. Abraham Lincoln had to do a lot of things that didn't sit too well with the Bill of Rights, suspending the writ of habeas corpus, and the maintenance of loyalty on the home front led to some pretty heavy-handed activities.
You could be sent to Alcatraz for exulting in the assassination of Lincoln when Lincoln was killed.
Right, and Bidwell, as the head of the militia, participated in shoring up home front loyalty, and he was not reluctant to arrest pro-Southern Democrats, especially the guys who kind of dominated Colusa County at the time.
Yeah, they called it the South Carolina of California.
Right,
Colusa,
right. And I think after Lincoln's assassination, there were several Southern Democrats here in Butte County and even more in Colusa who were rounded up and arrested by federal authorities, state militia and U.S. regular soldiers, and ended up performing hard labor on Alcatraz as their punishment for celebrating the assassination of Lincoln.
Because you think about all the battlefields are back east, that's where the Civil War took place, but Bidwell was fighting the Civil War right here in Butte County.
Right. The home front battle was very critical.
So then Bidwell is elected to Congress, and when he goes to Congress, his business here, his farm, Rancho Chico, falls apart under poor management, but he's not too disappointed because he gets to meet Annie Bidwell. And here is a life-changing event for Bidwell, another life-changing
event. Right. And that he only served one term in Congress. He grew disillusioned with politics, or so he claimed, although he left Congress a little bit disingenuous with that. I mean, the main reason he left Congress was he was ambitious to become governor of California. So he had higher ambitions at that time.
But he later said he wished he hadn't run.
he had a miserable experience with his gubernatorial ambitions. That was the one great frustration of his life. I think really the only place in his whole life he failed to achieve anything he ever set out to do. He was used to being successful. He was a hardworking, well-organized guy, very intelligent, and he usually got whatever he set out to do. But the governorship of California was the one thing that always eluded him.
Well, and he even ran for president of the United States, but I don't think that was very – he had his whole heart in that.
He didn't expect to win. He knew that was a ceremonial campaign as the head of the Prohibition Party ticket. And he was doing it just to wave the flag for Prohibition and to give them a prominent figure. But the races for governor, there was nothing ceremonial about those. He was dead set on getting elected governor, but never quite made it.
Well, when Annie comes to Chico, the place – Bidwell had employees, Indian, Chinese employees, but there was an Indian who was running his household. What kind of reception did Annie Bidwell get when she comes in?
Well, that's the famous Nopani, who has long been suspected, according to folklore, that was John Bidwell's first wife, a Native American wife. And she certainly was prominent in his pre-Annie Bidwell household as the cook and the chief domestic servant in the old adobe that Bidwell lived in before the Bidwell mansion was completed. And according to the story is when Annie first met Nopani, Nopani refused to turn over the keys to the newly constructed Bidwell mansion, insisting that she was Mrs. Bidwell number one, and Annie was simply Mrs. Bidwell number two. And Annie let Nopani keep the keys to the household rather than cause a real disturbance on Rancho Chico.
Well, speaking of the Indian issue, I understand that's your current project now. The book you're working on now has to do with the Indians. What is that book you're working on now?
Yeah, it's something that kind of grew out of the Bidwell book. It's another interest of mine for a long time, and that's the whole system of bound Indian labor that California legalized in 1850. Most of us were taught from fourth grade on, if not earlier, that California was a free state before the Civil War. And we were a free state in that we prohibited or we outlawed Southern slavery. But what most people don't know is that in 1850, the very first California legislature legalized a system of indentured servitude.
My guest is Professor Michael Magliari, who has studied Founding Father John Bidwell.
I'll be back with Professor Magliari after this break. You're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm Nancy Wigman. I'm Nancy Wigman, and you're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on National Public Radio. Today, we're listening again to an interview with Professor Michael Magliari, who wrote about John Bidwell. It's John Bidwell's 200th birthday, and we want to celebrate and honor his birthday by listening to the interview from 11 years ago. And actually, Professor Magliari had a co-author, the late Professor Michael Gillis, a colleague in the history department.
Right.
Welcome.
Thank you.
It's such a fascinating story of John Bidwell. Well, and at this period, he was known as General Bidwell that you're talking about when he was having guests at the mansion. But how did he come from this young man to being General Bidwell?
Well, the military title Bidwell received during the Civil War. That's product or an achievement that he earned during the Civil War when he was made a Brigadier General of the California State Militia by Leland Stanford. So he was actually in command of the California Militia for all of Northern California. And so he had responsibilities for keeping the peace during the Civil War. That included some dealings with Indians, but mainly policing Southern sympathizers. And most of Bidwell's Civil War was fought against neighbors who supported the South.
You mentioned Leland Stanford, who was governor mm-hmm. of California. That's one of many historical figures that Bidwell, John Bidwell, came in contact with and knew quite well. John Sutter was one mm-hmm. who took him under his wing and actually wanted John Bidwell to marry his own daughter.
Right.
But this relationship then resulted in John Bidwell having the financial means to buy this huge piece of property in Northern California.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, the relationship with Sutter got Bidwell started. I mean, Sutter, like you said, took him under his wing as a young man, and he worked for Sutter for most of the 1840s. But it was really his own striking out in the gold rush that enabled him to buy Rancho Chico. But he was very familiar with the Rancho Chico because as he worked for Sutter, he helped Sutter's real estate promotions, and he helped scout out and map Rancho Chico for the original Mexican grantees.
In fact, you say John Bidwell was responsible for naming 27 of California's counties.
Yeah, he had a role in that. He didn't name them all single-handedly or on his own, but he was on the first legislative committee, the very first legislature that was in charge of naming the counties. And one of the nice things that they did was incorporate a number of Indian names among the counties, but they do have a lot of Spanish and Indian names.
So John Bidwell acquires this property, and then he starts getting, because of his connections, he gets involved in politics. Mm-hmm. And there's a point when he has to leave his ranch in charge of other hands to go to Washington.
Right.
And that was pretty detrimental to his financial situation. Would you read that section when he's talking about going to Washington and having to leave his ranch in the hands of a manager?
Yeah, his manager didn't do a very good job when Bidwell was away in his 1 2-year term. And that's one reason he didn't go back for a second term. He says, and this is a letter to Annie in July 1867, "In my absence, I found that they had so badly done my business as to find $36,000 of debt. I don't want you to think I'm embarrassed," he says, "for I am not. I was never in debt until I went to Congress, but in my absence, my agent made mistakes. I had 18 head of fine mares that I kept separate. He put them into a stubble field where there was no water and went off 3 weeks on his own business and neglected to tell anyone to give the horses water. They all perished. I had about $10,000 worth of hogs and was offered 9.5 cents for them. He wanted 10. He would not take 9.5, a high price, but kept feeding them for a whole month and a half, and when prices went down, he undertook to make them into bacon, and when the summer came, it spoiled. I got in debt that way and have never gotten out since. I am not discouraged, but I do not think that it will do me any good to worry about it. I have learned by experience to be cautious in business matters for the sake of my wife and others. Although I lost a good deal in that way, I got something much more valuable than I lost. I got my wife by going there to Congress.
I think some people would be surprised at what he says there. He says that I went into debt and never got out.
Right.
Because people think of Bidwell, I mean, they see this huge mansion. He had a staff of servants. They think of him as a wealthy man. And yet he says he never got out of debt. He was never in debt before this.
Right. But when he died, Rancho Chico was, I think, I forget the figure, it's somewhere in our book, something like $400,000 in the red. And he operated in the red all throughout the late 19th century. But he always had good credit, so he was always able to make his interest payments and his payments on his loans. But he was always negotiating one loan after another. And he was typical of agriculture. A lot of that had to do with steadily declining farm prices in the late 19th century, and plus his own experiments in agricultural modernization, not all of which worked. But by renegotiating his loans, getting new loans to pay old loans through his connections in San Francisco banks, he was always able to maintain operations and make payments. But when he finally died, he had never caught up with all those debts.
You talked about him experimenting with modern agriculture. One idea that I hope is coming back is diversified agriculture, because we got into this planting one crop, and Bidwell planted a lot of different crops.
Right. That's what made Rancho Chico pretty unique in the late 19th century. And it, in the days before federal agricultural experiment stations, his Rancho Chico served as sort of a great model farm or experiment station for California farmers. And he experimented with just about everything. And Rancho Chico eventually became famous for all those specialty crops that he helped pioneer, almonds and a bunch of other orchard crops. But and a lot of people, the ranch became so famous for that that people lose sight of the fact that the financial foundation of Rancho Chico always remained the big cash crop of California during the late 19th century, and that was wheat. Wheat was the foundation for everything else Bidwell did. Wheat and also flour. I mean, the flour mill was probably the single largest moneymaker or source of income for Bidwell at Rancho Chico.
And because of producing the wheat, he had to have a way to get it to market. So then he became interested in how do I get the – I mean, Chico is landlocked. So how is he going to get this to markets? And the railroad, of course, is what was the way.
Right. Well, it, actually, Chico's not quite landlocked. We think of it that way today because when we go out to the Sacramento River, the only navigation taking place anymore are Chico State students on inner tubes. But and it's hard to imagine what you would have seen in the late 19th century with large steamboats pulling barges, navigating up the Sacramento River all the way up to Red Bluff, which was the head of navigation. So Bidwell was very interested in river navigation, and he had a landing, Chico Landing, in fact, where most of the inner tubers put in, was where Bidwell had his own landing. And wheat was shipped down by steamboats to the Bay Area for shipment eventually to England. But that was slow and inefficient, and Bidwell was always a promoter of railroad transportation for all kinds of other reasons, although he was a big opponent of Southern Pacific Railroad monopoly. And he ended up actually having a falling out with his friend Leland Stanford over all that.
In fact, when he first went to Washington, he had to go by boat. And
right.
then in his lifetime, the Transcontinental Railroad was linked, and he was able after that to go by rail.
Yeah, and I tell my students that I think One of the important effects of the Transcontinental Railroad, just on a small individual scale, was that I think the Transcontinental Railroad made John and Annie's marriage possible. They were kind of the original bi-coastal commuters, or she was. And I don't think—
Because of her mother.
Well, yeah, her mother and her— Well, she was close to her father as well and her
but
sisters.
Her mother was a little more insistent, wasn't she?
Yes, yeah. She was kind of an intrusive mother-in-law, and there was a lot of that element there. But I don't think Annie would have ever agreed to marry John Bidwell and move out to a frontier place like Chico, even with the mansion being built at that time. She probably would never have agreed to marry him and come out here. If it wasn't for the railroad, they get married in 1868, and the railroad is being constructed at that time, and it's completed the very next year. And part of their marriage agreement was annual trips back to visit her family every year. And normally she spent at least a month, sometimes 2 months, back east in Washington and Philadelphia visiting her family. And those absences are great. Were great for Mike Gillis and I because— During those absences, they generated just reams of letters back and forth. So whenever she's gone, we get great letters from John writing daily at the end of his long day, long letters to her describing everything that's going on in the rancho. And she wrote back maybe once every 3 or 4 days. And so he always outpaced her. And very often he'd complain that he wasn't getting letters as frequently as he was writing them.
Because she had a very nice life there. Society, yeah. Her family was quite a distinguished family.
Right.
That Bidwell became acquainted with. And so she wasn't that eager to say goodbye to that life that she knew in Washington and come to California.
They were part of the upper echelons of Philadelphia and Washington society. And in fact, her father was the head of the United States Census. And in fact, her father was the creator of the modern scientific census starting in 1840 in the 1850s. So a very prominent, well-connected political family.
In fact, their wedding, their guest list was rather impressive. Tecumseh, William Tecumseh Sherman and Ulysses S. Grant were the people that attended their wedding.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was a big Washington affair. And, you know, he married well above himself in terms of where he had come from, in terms of his origins.
In fact, wasn't Grant stationed out here in California and was really bored silly, started drinking because of his boredom? And
yeah, that was Grant's earlier undistinguished career out of West Point. He was stationed out here in the 1850s. And garrison duty at some place like Fort Humboldt in the 1850s was pretty dreary. And I think any of us would have taken to drink under those, except John Bidwell. He wouldn't have. But the rest of us surely would have. And Grant, that led to him leaving the Army and not to return until the Civil War broke out.
So they had this distinguished guest list, and you were talking about being driven to drink. But John Bidwell was one of the reasons you said that Annie agreed to marry him is that John said, yes, you can go back and visit your family
right.
often. But also, John, we talked about his diversified agriculture. One of the things that he planted was grapes for wine.
Right.
What does he say about that?
Yeah, he was very enthusiastic about the possibility of California for winemaking, commercial winemaking. And here's something he writes. Let's see, the date on this was, I think, 1860, in an address to the California State Agricultural Society, where he's promoting the raising of wine grapes and the making of wine. Quote, California is emphatically the land of the vine, and can there be any doubt that we can produce the finest wines? This is an important question because we are actually importing in casks, barrels, baskets, and cases millions of gallons every year, and yet it is admitted that there is not a land beneath the sun better suited to grape culture than California.
So he was ahead of his time realizing that.
Yeah, I mean, Chico could have been the original Napa Valley.
I was thinking that when I read that, yeah. Except for the fact that he loved Annie.
Right, and her Presbyterianism, very active Presbyterianism, wouldn't really tolerate involvement in the manufacture of wine and alcoholic beverages. And it's kind of ironic because not only is he promoting that on his own rancho, but in Congress, one of his pet projects was protecting California's emerging wine industry from taxation. So as a member of Congress, he was trying to protect and promote winemaking. At the same time, he's courting and meeting Annie. And then when he comes back to Rancho Chico and marries Annie, he ends up altering his vineyard. It becomes a born-again vineyard, so to speak, a Presbyterian vineyard, and it's reconverted from out of wine grapes into raisin grapes. And he ends up helping to pioneer raisins in California, in the Sacramento Valley.
So he marries Annie, and Annie, being a good Presbyterian, one of the first things she wants to do is create a Presbyterian church here in this community of Chico, this town of Chico that's growing up. And I thought it was pretty funny that people think, oh, here's this rich Bidwell. If we run short of funds, we'll just get him to finance this church.
Right. And he was constantly being tapped, well, not just by the Presbyterian church, but just about everybody in town, including the Masonic Lodge. In fact, Bidwell left the Masonic Lodge, which he helped found. But when he got late in payment, or he neglected to pay his dues one year, and the Lodge brothers got on his case about it, and he was so annoyed and miffed by that, since he had pretty much subsidized them their whole early years of existence, that he quit in disgust. But he was always being hit up for money. And part of what why that put so much pressure on him was he was always in debt after coming back from Congress, and most people didn't understand that. They all assumed he was rich and that his financial affairs were always well into the black when they're actually well into the red.
But he has this beautiful estate. In fact, there was a visitor, and visitors were expected, they were expected to accommodate visitors that came to Chico,
right,
put them up. But one visitor from Australia describes the beauty of Rancho Chico, and this visitor from Australia said Bidwell valued some things in the world more highly than money. I think that speaks well of Bidwell right there, that he valued some things in the world more highly than money. And he talks about Bidwell as a lover of trees and natural beauty. What else does he say? You have that section there.
Yeah, this was the Australian journalist Thomas Dow, who toured California trying to promote agriculture in Australia and comparing it with California. And he toured Rancho Chico in 1883 and had a lot of good things to say. He wrote a beautiful, one of the best written descriptions of Rancho Chico. It was in Dow's book, his tour of farms in California. Dow, in this passage, we talk about Dow praising Bidwell as a lover of trees and natural beauty, who values some things in the world more highly than money. On Rancho Chico, not even the all-powerful American dollar would be able to bring about the destruction of a favorite oak, an avenue, or a bit of charming scenery. Not only have the natural beauties of the country been preserved, but heaps of gold derived from its productiveness have been expended upon developing and increasing the pleasing appearance of the estate. The property of 25,000 acres is like a group of delightful parks, and one drives for hours in every direction along charming avenues without ever losing the sense of rural beauty.
Those of us who live in Chico now really are so grateful because we have the third largest municipal park in the United States right here in Chico, thanks to the Bidwells.
Yeah, that third is what the most recent claim I've heard. We're one of the biggest. I don't know where exactly we rank.
Yeah, I've heard other things too,
right.
but it's thanks to the Bidwells that we have this beauty here. And don't you wish more founding fathers, if we want to call them that, valued beauty over stripping the land of everything they could get?
Oh, yes. I mean, this is a real unique legacy, and Bidwell was very conscious of it the whole time. I mean, even before the park donation was made by Annie, and that was something the two of them had agreed on before his death, that a large portion of the land, especially the canyon, the banks of the stream, would be donated to the city. But even before that, during John's lifetime, while the ranch was a functioning economic entity, he always maintained it as a quasi-public park and welcomed the people of Chico onto the ranch as long as they didn't drink and they behaved. He welcomed people and invited them to use the parts of the Rancho for picnicking and so forth.
So we owe a great debt to the Bidwells in that regard of keeping Chico so beautiful. Bidwell, as he progressed in his life and ran the Chico Ranch, had encounters with various minority groups that mm-hmm. worked on his ranch.
Right.
The Indians, I thought it was very interesting, his relationships to the Indians, because a lot of people felt, you hear the expression, there's the only good Indian is a dead Indian, and a lot of people thought that Indians were untrustworthy and dangerous. And John Bidwell didn't think that. He had good relationships with the Indians.
Yes, he did, and particularly with the Machupta, who, of course, were here before Bidwell established Rancho Chico and then continued to live on the ranch property when Bidwell assumed ownership. And they really provided the foundation of Rancho Chico's community and Bidwell's labor force. And Bidwell always kind of prided himself on his ability to get along with Indians. And here's a passage from his, I think this is from his 1891 memoir. And he says, quote, "Now with the Indians, I never had any trouble. Some men could not go long among the Indians without having trouble with them. I seemed to have a sort of intuitive insight into the Indian character." I think a little bit of an exaggerated claim there, but he was close there. One thing I can say, I have never justified any abuse or wrong treatment of the Indian. I had for them a regard, a sympathy, knowing that their lands had always been taken from them without any compensation. I have never justified the cruel treatment of them, which I know very frequently was unjustifiable.
In fact, he not only didn't justify it, he didn't tolerate. There's an instance where some people were mistreating the female Indian workers, mm-hmm. and he got shot at because of that. And do you remember that part?
Let's see. He talked about how I think he actually took a whip to a man who had been abusing a Native American woman, one of his employees on Rancho Chico. And he said he never had any patience with white men who behaved that way. And so a little muscular morality on Rancho Chico enforced by John Bidwell.
And he had also said Chinese workers on mm-hmm. His ranch. And you you currently now are looking into that a little more thoroughly with your current project, aren't you, about Indians in California?
Yes. One of the things I was most interested in about Bidwell when we started this book was his alleged authorship of the notorious 1850 Indian Act of the California Legislature, which provided for the virtual enslavement of Native Americans, even though California was supposed to be a free state. And that law set up a system of indentured servitude for Indians and convict leasing, various legalized forms of slavery. And as it turns out, Bidwell didn't author that law, and we explain all that pretty clearly in our book.
This is your current project.
Yeah, and since I've gone on to do, I'm doing work on that law and the whole history of that law.
We're talking to Professor Michael Magliari about his book, John Bidwell and California, The Life and Writings of a Pioneer, 1841 to 1900. I'm Nancy Wigman.
You've been listening to Nancy's Bookshelf, a production of North State Public Radio. You can find this and other episodes of Nancy's Bookshelf on our website, mynspr.org.